everybody. Welcome to the Hallmarkies podcast. I'm so excited today to bring you another interview. We love talking to Hallmark writers. And today we have another chance to talk with a Hallmark writer. We're talking with writer Topher Payne today. And this is going to be really fun. I'm really thrilled. I'm Rachel. And Topher, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So what we like to do is to ask our guests to introduce yourself and tell us what inspired you to become a writer.
Well, I grew up in Mississippi, and I come from a family of very, very gifted storytellers. None of them were foolish enough to try to make a living at it, but that was how I learned my family history, you know, is through stories. And I was raised in the Methodist Church, where everything I learned about kind of our way of being in the world was taught through parable. And so storytelling was just so steeped in the culture that I was raised in. I don't think that's unique to the South, but I think Southerners are particularly good at it.
Yeah.
And so growing up, whenever I was trying to make sense out of something, I tended to put it to paper. And I believe writing is an engine for teaching yourself empathy, teaching yourself compassion, and considering the perspective of somebody in a different pair of shoes. And that kind of naturally evolved into, as my questions started to get more complex, I wanted to take those questions out into the world. And that led me to the first stage of my career as a playwright. And I premiered my first play when I was 21.
Wow.
And then kept right on going.
That's really amazing. You first play at 21. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Was it just at your
school? It's all I knew how to do. I professionally started as a technician in theater. Uh-huh. And so I was working in electrics, building sets, painting sets, really anything that would let me do. And I did that for 2 years in Mississippi, starting when I was 17. And when I was 19, I came to Atlanta hoping to find my fortune in theater. And when you're 19 years old, you can believe that's possible. Mm-hmm. And then got mixed up with a really great group of storytellers here in town and wanted to start telling my own stories. And I was surrounded with people who were telling me yes. Which is how all amazing things happen, you know?
Right.
My first play was, I actually went back and reread it a couple of years ago, and it charitably showed a lot of promise. But I tell students now, you know, how do you write a good script? You write a bad script and make it better.
Right.
And just keep working at it, because as I have found, editing a work is much harder than generating the first draft of it.
Yeah.
And so you just power through that first draft and recognize, the first draft is always going to be, you know, just a complete unmitigated disappointment. And so you get that out of the way and then you keep going.
Yeah. That's like the gift of NaNoWriMo is just kind of, at least for me, is that just getting that first idea out on some kind of paper and just blah, get it out there. And then
But that's precisely it. And you know, and now with exercises like that simply prioritize your right to write.
Yeah.
Because I didn't receive any formal training in this, you know. I was a teenager that showed up in a building where they tell stories and asked if I could play. Certainly in the early years of my career, that was something I struggled with, that there were people who, from my perception, it came easier to, or they were more profound. They had more lived-in experience, or whatever excuse you want to tell yourself to believe you don't deserve what you want. And getting on the other side of that and just recognizing I absolutely have the right to write, as we all do. Yeah. And stories are the engine that generate compassion.
Yeah. And you never know where
which you're... kind of naturally led me to writing the sort of movies I write now, you know?
Yeah. And you never know, where your journey will take you. My sister, she, long wanted to be a kind of more of a fantasy type of author, young adult kind of author. And she ended up writing picture stories, picture books. And that's where she's found kind of a niche. And so, life's kind of, it's interesting.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
But I like what you said about growing up on the South. It reminds me of an interview with author Lee Smith, where she said that the great thing about the South is not that they can tell a good story, but they can make anything into a story.
A good story.
Anything that happens. Yeah, she was saying, she's like, if a woman is not wearing a very nice dress, it's bless her heart.
Bless her heart.
Bless
but
her
then
heart.
Her hair looks so good.
But yeah, that's right.
Her hair looks so good. You always find the compliment you can couch within.
That's really funny. So how did you end up writing for Hallmark? How did that happen?
It was much to my surprise. I had a play that went off Broadway in 2015 called Perfect Arrangement. And it was that perfect confluence of events. You never know who's going to see your work, how it's going to reach people, and when the right people will be in the right room at the right time. And with that production, we got some really solid reviews out of it and started getting some positive attention. And that led to me developing a relationship with who would eventually become my manager, Scott Alley. And he brought me out to LA to do a series of meetings just to get to know people and let them get to know me. I hadn't written in the medium before, but I love telling stories and would love to have the chance to reach a new audience. So we did a lot of meetings on that trip, and I, thanks to my mother and my big sister, had seen a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies. Every time I go home to Mississippi, that's just, it's what's playing in the background the entire time I'm there. And I asked Scott if he could set me up with a conversation with Hallmark. I was really, really interested, more than anything else, to just have a conversation with the people who decide what stories are told there, about what their priorities are as storytellers. I think because I had such low expectations coming out for the trip, I had not previously expected to be moving into television at that particular moment in my career. And I just saw it as an opportunity to sit down with people and get some legit answers on why they tell the stories they tell. Mm-hmm. And I was Scott's first client to request a meeting at Hallmark, which I thought was nuts, because if you're looking for work, they make a lot of movies.
That's true.
And then that conversation at Hallmark ended up being the most, like, just special experience of that trip. Because, yeah, we talked about Hallmark movies and we talked about our plays, but we spent most of the time talking about the Hallmark audience and what their goals are in telling stories to that audience. And there was a lot of crossover with what Hallmark's priorities were and what my priorities are as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Going back again to that idea of story being a chance to build empathy and build compassion.
Yeah.
And so it was just a really great conversation.
Yeah.
And so this was in the spring of 2016. And my plan was I was going to spend the summer learning how to write for television. And, I figure I taught myself how to write plays. I can teach myself how to write screenplays. And so I said I would be available to take a project in the fall if that was something that was interesting to them. And 2 weeks later, they needed a writer to step in and do a rewrite on an existing piece that they already had in development. And opportunity knocked. And they said, we know you said you weren't available till September, but if you want to start today, you can. And that became my Summer Prince, my first Hallmark movie. Uh-huh.
So I
taught myself how to write it as I was writing it.
Nice. So had you heard of Hallmark? Like, had you watched them? Did you know what the brand kind of was?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Again, thanks to Mama and my big sister, Shannon, who were big, big fans. Big, big fans. And my sister has two sons, both under age 13. And Hallmark is a really good thing to have on TV in the background that you as a parent don't have to check in on.
Right.
And so when we're all gathering for the holidays and you just kind of have that background noise, and then like people perch on the sofa and watch for 20 minutes, but then they get sucked in and suddenly the whole family's watching a movie, that's Hallmark at their house.
Yeah.
And so I had been sucked into many a Lacey Chabert movie before I came in. And I could definitely see that, there were some story beats that I could see were consistent in their storytelling. There were, the things that people jokingly call the Hallmark formula and I call the Hallmark recipe. And so I could see what was going on there. And that was really where I wanted to get to the root of the people making the decisions about these stories and specifically why the stories are told the way they're told and what opportunities we could have to innovate within that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Interesting. So, yeah, I know what you mean about them being a kind of background movies. Even I, who love them and talk about them all the time, I'll have them on sometimes as just as background to just kind of relax and just, I don't know, there's just something really sweet and really pleasant about them. And I don't know, they make you like, even I feel like we, even their flaws are somehow sort of charming usually.
Yeah, there's, because there are quirks to the storytelling that, yeah. There are consistent story beats that we see again and again.
Yeah.
And what becomes a delightful challenge for me as a writer is knowing, there's a couple of things. You have 85 minutes to tell this story when you cut out commercials. And so I need to, as a writer, introduce you to the world these characters inhabit, introduce you to the problem, develop, that first encounter of the guy and the girl, and then tell you a complete satisfying story of courtship over the course of 85 minutes.
Yeah.
And we're going to be taking 8 breaks in the midst of that where I've got to leave you with something that then will bring you back after the commercial break.
Yeah.
And so it does lend itself to a certain recipe for success.
Yeah.
These are, you know, these are the established kind of touchstones that you can hit that's going to get you where you need to get to give you room to tell your story.
Yeah.
So in the first 20 minutes, the following things need to happen or you're not going to get where you need to go. And so when we see repetition of that, that's kind of the logic behind it, is I've got to cover a certain amount of ground so that I can tell you the story that's really important for me to tell.
Yeah. Well, and people act like a formula is a bad thing. And I disagree. I think that uninspired formula is a bad thing, but
yeah.
I think that sometimes a formula can actually give a writer and a director a little bit more sort of room to kind of play where they don't have to reinvent the wheel with every movie. And
that's exactly it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And within that, like knowing that I am going to be doing that, how can I still surprise you?
Right.
We, I had a wonderful producer I'm working with again on another project on A Gift to Remember. And we knew that we were going to be hitting a lot of those expected story beats and then deliberately, with great intention, finding ways to turn those expectations ever so slightly in a different direction,
yeah.
Which I think is immensely satisfying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's why I personally think the, like, for instance, the Marvel movies are better, in my opinion, than the Star Wars movies, because I feel like with the Star Wars movies, it's just been kind of left to the director to sort of figure it out for each one. One's a war movie, one's a, you know, whatever. And that's
yeah.
hard to do. Whereas like the Marvel movies, they got it. They got the plan. Now Taika Waititi can come in and do his little flair to the formula, and Joss Whedon can do his little flair to the formula and whatever it might be. And so it makes for a really satisfying experience because you know what you're sitting down to watch, and at least in my opinion, and they know how to execute it well. They're not trying to do anything other than what they're doing. And that's
I think that's
Hallmark.
Yeah. I think that's an incredible example, because you look at two movies like Captain America, The Winter Soldier versus yeah. Black Panther,
right.
which were both incredibly satisfying movies, but existing in very different storytelling spaces, even as they're hitting a lot of the same beats.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you can look at Shakespeare plays and see the consistent story beats that are hit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make each one in isolation any less satisfying.
Yeah.
I find what really makes the difference between a story well told or not is this group of storytellers trying to communicate something that matters to them?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is absolutely achievable within the Hallmark recipe.
Yeah.
It kind of is the Hallmark recipe.
Yeah. Well, and it's so hard too with romantic stories, is that so much of it is almost without outside of anyone's control, because it's just an intangible of chemistry. Because you can have,
yep.
just like in dating, you can have like somebody on paper that is perfect for you and that you should get along with great. And then you go on, you know, you go on a couple dates with them and it's like, don't like, this doesn't work at all. It's like, what? And that's how it sometimes can be with romantic comedies. It's like all the pieces, these people, this should work, but I'm just not feeling it. Like, it's just not. And that must be very frustrating, because how can you plan for that? You can't. All you can do is you try your best to put people together that you think will have that chemistry, and then hope it works, because that's a
right.
huge part of these movies working.
Yeah. And I think, again, it goes back to, do I believe that what the story is telling me is important to this character? Do I
yeah.
believe
yeah.
love to come in on female characters with the issue of likability? which is a horrible, horrible trigger for me as a writer. I don't care if my female lead is likable. What I care about is, do you care about her?
Yeah.
Because we are all achingly human and flawed. And in storytelling, you want to see a character that you care about make mistakes along the way, learn from those mistakes, and grow. And that means that at the beginning of our story, then the central characters that we're focusing on are going to be a little flawed because they have room to grow. And I love exploring that. And I also think that serves as an assist for the actors playing the roles because it gives them something to hang their hat on. She starts here, she ends here. Okay, now I know what I'm doing with this. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, here's my theory on that, is that I think everybody's trying to be Pride and Prejudice because, of course, it's Pride and Prejudice. But the thing that people forget about Pride and Prejudice is that Lizzie and Darcy are both shown to be beloved by everybody else in their life. They just don't happen to like each other. And I think that that's what's missing a lot of times in this, is that you'll have people that are just hateful and you just don't like them because they're not nice people. And so you're not really rooting for them. So then when they get together at the end, you're just like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've long said that I think that every romantic comedy is either based on Taming of the Shrew or Pride and Prejudice. It's either some kind of bet or gimmick, you know, kind of a thing, like gotta write an article, gotta whatever, like Taming of the Shrew, or they're trying to be Pride and Prejudice where they just, you know, they hate each other but they really are meant for each other. And I think with Taming of the Shrew, you have to be either really funny to make that kind of gimmick premise pay off. Like Greek Wedding, I think, is a great one where it was just a real gimmick, but it was so funny that it worked for me. to make that one work, there's so many of them that don't work, though, that are trying that. Some kind of bet or some kind of thing like that where you're just like, and
right. And there's, you know, and there's that vein of people that are trying to write a Hepburn and Tracy crackling little unexpected romance, and they just end up writing two miserable people that are like sniping at each other the whole time. I'm like, well, I think you deserve each other, but not in the way you intended.
Exactly. You have to make good use of your best friend character. It's a very important character. And that's what's so great about, like, in my opinion, my favorite writer in the whole world is Nora Ephron. She was just amazing to me. I know she had her flops, but I just love her writing. And if you think about something like You've Got Mail, which so many people try to copy and do terribly, that both Joe and Kathleen both had friends, BFF friends, to talk to. And so you got to know them, and they got to know each other through the emails that you got to hear. So you got to hear their true self, and they just didn't get along as business people, which is totally understandable, but that's not who they really are. And
exactly.
And so I just feel like 99% of the people that try to do You've Got Mail totally miss. And you could, you know, you say shop around the corner as well, but I don't know. They just totally miss that core of they are defining themselves by their jobs for the very beginning of the movie. That's who they are. And then by the end, they realize that's not who they are. And the person that they were when they were talking to each other in the chat room, that's who they really are. And
exactly.
Yeah. So, and plus, I mean, just Nora Ephron's hilarious. She's so funny.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I just love her writing so much. But anyway, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that yes, because it's predictable is not necessarily a flaw. Because they're unlikable is not necessarily a flaw. All that's saying, I think when people say it's unlikable is because they don't have that because they're kept the antagonist sort of in that thing too long.
We are not given the opportunity to forge an emotional connection.
And
if you're not given the opportunity to forge an emotional investment, and care about what they care about, even if they're making terrible choices. I mean, good Lord, think of like the age of the anti-hero on television,
right?
Where you can have characters like Don Draper or, you know, Glenn Close on Damages, just real monsters. But they give us the opportunity to understand the explanation behind the approach, even if we as an audience are saying, please don't make that choice. But then we're also really satisfied when they do. As long as I'm invested in the reasons behind it, as long as I feel like I understand this person as a complete human, which is where the best friend character or, you know, the like sympathetic boss or somebody's got a great mom, when you've got that opportunity to present a more complex portrait of who this person is, well, then you can sign up for it because you care.
Yeah. A great example of that in romantic comedy world is Love and Friendship with Stillman. You know, because she's terrible. She's a terrible human being. But like, you completely understand where she's coming from. And she's literally making every single person in her life better and making better choices than all of them would ever make. So you can't really be that mad at her.
Have you seen Russian Doll on Netflix yet?
No, I've heard really good things, but I haven't seen
it. Oh my God, it's so good. But what's amazing is in the midst of this very, very high concept show, at the core of it, it's about Natasha Lyonne's character just trying to forge an authentic connection with another person. And how much she gets in her own way in the process of that. And she's reliving the same night of her life over and over and over until she's actually able to break through the same mistake she's been making her entire adult life. And what makes it awesome isn't the high concept or like, you know, all that Netflix money they throw at it, but all that helps. What makes it awesome, what makes you keep coming back, is that you are so invested in her getting this right, you know? And I love that. I love a story that engages me that way.
That's really cool. Well, so you said your first movie, My Summer Prince. So you did, it was basically a complete rewrite on that, basically, that you did, or?
Yeah, I did a complete rewrite on that. And then came in on Broadcasting Christmas with the same producer and director immediately after we finished My Summer Prince.
My Summer Prince.
No, go ahead.
My Summer Prince. Did you get to be on set for that at all, or anything like that, or was it?
Yes, I did.
I even
have a little cameo in it. If you watch, there's an elevator scene, and the tourist in the elevator is your screenwriter.
You have been in our neck of the woods then, because I'm from Utah, so.
It's so beautiful out there.
Yeah.
And I tell you, Utah in the summer doesn't get nearly enough credit. It is beautiful out there in the summer. And I got to be on set for that with Taylor Cole and Jack Turner and Marina Sirtis, and Lauren Holly and I are direct message buddies on Twitter now, constantly shooting back and forth. It was the best possible set of circumstances. Peter Sullivan, my director on that film, and my producers knew that this was my first time at bat, and their patience and generosity of spirit in that process, knowing we have an experienced storyteller who is just learning a new way to tell stories.
Right.
Their guidance through that process, I owe them immensely. But that's that ended up becoming kind of the defining characteristic of most of my professional relationship with Hallmark, is they choose good people to work with, who are there for the right reasons. And everybody is lifting everybody else up. And so that was an amazing set to be on, and such a tremendous first experience.
That's really, really great. Yeah, I haven't heard anything different from any, I mean, all these interviews. Not that it, I doubt someone would be coming on our podcast and be like, oh, it was horrible, but still, everything I've read, in the era of Me Too and all that stuff, the fact that we haven't had, you know, too many stories about, you know, women being treated badly on Hallmark or anything like that. Like, we just, it's all been like pretty positive. There's a few little things here and there, but for the most part, I've been so impressed with everybody's experience. Seems to be really positive, and that makes me happy. And it's really cool that you got to work with Peter Sullivan twice there.
Yeah.
Start you off.
I mean, and that guy, I mean, if you want an education on how a Hallmark movie works, Peter is a great man to sit across from.
Yeah.
And, but yeah. And then I signed for Broadcasting Christmas the day after My Summer Prince premiered. Mm. And so I went from never having written a movie to having written two movies inside of a year. And then with Melissa and Dean and Jack A, who is one of the funniest people I have ever been in the same room with.
Yes.
And it was just, you know, we shoot fast. I think, and, you know, I don't feel like I'm telling a tale out of school there. These movies are made fast.
Yes.
And from inception of the script to final broadcast edit, it is unparalleled on television how quickly they are able to generate these things. And it's because they have very, very experienced people who know what they're doing, and they keep a joyful set.
Yeah.
And I know from my experience in doing theater, that if you do not run a positive room, then you're never going to get the product you're looking for. Not really. Nobody wants to feel like working with you is something they survived. And I know that there are plenty of people that, you know, we put in that category of tortured geniuses who are worth the trouble. And I think that mindset is exactly what leads us to situations like the Me Too movement.
Right.
When you start making allowances for artists that do not prioritize being good people, then once we make room for that, there will be consequences. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great blessing in my life that so far, knock the closest piece of wood, I haven't encountered a set where we make those kinds of allowances.
Right.
And I haven't encountered leadership that believes in that idea, because I think that's a recipe for getting messy real quick.
Yeah, I agree. Do you have any differences in sort of your mindset of writing a Christmas movie like Broadcasting Christmas versus a non-Christmas movie?
All right, I'm going to be completely candid. The Christmas movies are more of a creative challenge than the non-Christmas movies.
Uh-huh.
And the reason for that is because there are only so many things people do at Christmas. And they have made 200 Christmas movies. I am, and I say that as a writer who is in process on a Christmas movie right now while it's 75 degrees outside. But because, as I said, I'm always looking for how can I innovate? How can I delight the audience with the unexpected? with a summer film, you have the vast landscape of all summer possibilities. And when you are doing a Christmas story, try to think of something that another writer hasn't already beat you to the punch on. Yeah. And so it is absolutely more of a challenge. And I think I can be a real pain in the butt for my network executives while I am in process saying, but I've already seen that. I've already seen that. And I want to find something else. And they are fully supportive of me finding something else, but they would also like for me to finish the script.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I have to say, last year, I think Lifetime did a little bit better job of finding something else. Like, they had their, as far as just thinking outside the box a little bit, like they had their Nutcracker Come Alive movie. They had the girl waking up in the Irish Christmas village. That's perfect. They had a fairly interesting take on Christmas Carol, I thought, just some of the different things that they did that were just a little creative. And so that was, you know, that was fun, where I felt like Hallmark was kind of, most of them were sort of workplace romances in some way or another, which is fine. Planning a party, that was a big thing last year. Planning the party.
Well, and I tell you, you know, but the other side of that is, because of course, you know, we were seeing some significant new storytelling elements coming into Hallmark last year, like with Christmas Everlasting. And yeah, that's not just what the cast looked like, but also the content of the film. Yeah. One of the things that, because this goes back to that very first conversation that I had at their office, is this audience has given you their trust and their time.
Yeah.
And you have to tread carefully with that. You have to respect that responsibility. And part of what that means is knowing when to move the needle forward and introduce new storytelling elements or, you know, really going outside the box and trying something bold. And when you need to honor the audience's,
yeah,
expectations when they turn on the Hallmark channel. And that's a very fine line, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous responsibility to carry. I think it's very distinctive for me because I came to Hallmark in 2016, which is a very specific year in American culture.
Yeah.
And I have continued to tell these stories as the dialogue within communities has become a lot more fraught, and
yeah,
and people have gotten a little more tentative about the unfamiliar. People are looking for things that reinforce a sense of goodness and to a certain extent predictability.
Yeah.
People want to know that something can be dependable.
Yeah.
And it's a curious thing being a writer for an institution like Hallmark at that time, because you know that you have the opportunity to promote a healing effect on your audience. And allow people a sense of calm in a time when it is desperately needed,
yeah,
while also looking for ways to advance storytelling and move the needle forward and get them to consider new possibilities. And the only thing I can say, you know, just from my own perspective, is that's something I am aware of every time I sit down to write, you yeah know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that's completely true. And giving something that everybody can find some joy in. I mean, that's what Christmas yeah is supposed to be all about anyway. And
yeah,
So yeah, it's really funny. I mean, we've interviewed tons of writers, and a couple of them are Jewish writers. They're trying to find, all this. What's the next thing that I can find out, talk about to write on as far as Christmas, which is a really funny dynamic. I can't imagine what's going on. But anyway, yeah, I really enjoyed broadcasting Christmas. I think that one's a lot of fun. I think you did a nice job with that. And then we loved A Gift to Remember. It was one of our favorites. If not, it was Amber, I believe, favorite of that year. And I was wondering, were you at all kind of thinking about while you were sleeping at all as kind of a sort of an inspiration at all, or no? Or because it felt like it was
Yeah, that one was based on a book. And, okay. And so my first step in that process, that was my first literary adaptation as a playwright or as a screenwriter. Okay. So it was my first opportunity to work with someone else's pre-existing content. And so I started at the core with Melissa Hill's book, which is delightful. And Melissa and I are Twitter friends too. But and so I felt a tremendous responsibility to honor the spirit of the author's work while recognizing I'm taking, you know, a 300-page book and turning it into an 85-minute movie. Okay. And so with that, there's only so much of the specific plot element of her novel that can transfer over because we don't have time. Sure. And so taking the structure of her story and then finding a way to give myself permission to make it my own story, yeah, so that I'm not just working in service of somebody else's book. And so the basic concept of how Darcy and Aiden meet and then the journey that Darcy goes on tracks from the book to the film. And then I had the challenge of, I've got a guy with a head injury who's in the hospital for 45 minutes of my movie.
I mean, it doesn't hurt that that's your forte, though. I mean, if there's going to be somebody who's going to capture your interest for 45 minutes in a hospital, that's a good choice.
My husband says he looks like Prince Eric from Little Mermaid, and now that's all I see.
He does look like, oh my gosh, that's so true.
If they ever do the live action, the yes, man has a gig, I swear.
You need to tell Lynn Miranda and all the people about that. They're making the version. Yeah.
I don't know if he can sing and dance, but dang it, he's got time to learn. Come on.
That's right. They don't care about that in the Disney remakes anyway.
Clearly.
No. Yeah. but yeah, I mean, so you're working with him again, though, in the sequel, but in Roman Love as well, right? With Peter Porter?
Yes, they're shooting Roman Love right now.
Oh, I guess she's your good luck charm.
She really is. And that was such a stroke of good luck for us. I didn't even realize Peter was up for consideration for that film. I knew with the project that I'm currently working on that I was writing for his voice again. Having him come in on Roman Love is just a real bonus, because I think he's such a delightful performer and he's so endearing. And dang if he's not the most likable human being in real life too. I haven't found the reason to hate him yet, but I believe me, I'm still looking. I mean, it would help if he just weren't so darn ugly, you know, but
so is that, do you know at all, can you say, is that going to be like are they doing the Rome movies in summer, or do you have any idea?
You know, I never want to scoop my boss on anything, but What I can say is I am currently shooting a movie called Rome in Love, based on the book Rome in Love by Anita Hughes. Peter Porte and Italia Ricci are our stars in that.
Right.
And it takes place in Italy in the summer. And that's all I can tell you.
All right. There you go. Yeah, I know that.
I'll get a tweet from Michelle so fast.
I mean, I know that Julie Sherman Wolf is also working on a Rome movie. So I know it's a thing. So I'm waiting for that season. But
it would stand to reason that we may have a series of movies about exciting European holidays this summer. I'm just guessing.
So excited. All right. Very good. You did a good job there. So
thanks.
You're writing the sequel to Get to Remember as we speak, right?
Just for fun.
Yes. Well, let me give you some advice on writing Hallmark sequels.
Please.
A lot of times I feel like they have the couple together and then they kind of don't know what to do next. Like, people want a sequel. Mm-hmm. But do they really want a sequel? And so their choice is to make things really dark and weird. And all of a sudden they have all of this conflict that's like too real. Like, it might
You are
be
speaking
real.
To my heart right now. You are speaking so to my heart right now.
I think that the Perfect Bride sequel did it just about as good as I think you can do it, where all of their conflict was all that came up was there was never a second where you believed that they were ever going to split up or they were ever going to, you know, there was never any like giving back the ring or anything like that. It was natural conflict. That's fine. But it's a tricky thing. But yeah, all of a sudden these sequels.
Here's the thing I love about Gift to Remember. It's all summed up in Mrs. Henley's line, helping others reveals the best version of ourselves.
Yeah.
And that, more than anything else, as a writer, is what I was trying to communicate in that script, that Darcy experiences an awakening of confidence and purpose through helping Aiden. And so if in the first film our focus was Aiden is the one who is clearly in need, and Darcy is responsible in that story for seeing him to the other side of that, then the thing that I need to see in a sequel to understand how this relationship is equitable is, all right, now I've got to see Aiden step it up. He doesn't have a head injury this time. He remembers his last name. He is good to go. and then beyond that, there's Mrs. Henley, who was such a wonderful supporting influence in the first film, but she was very much working in support of her friend.
Sure.
And so in that idea of the joy of giving, then I'm looking to flip that as well, where my question coming in on the sequel, which again, it, you know, nothing's been announced. I'm just writing it for fun, sure.
Right.
Was, okay, this time, how can we support Darcy and how can we support Mrs. Henley?
Yeah. Because what romance novels do for sequels is they have, because you've already got the couple together in the first book, so you can't, it's hard to have a sequel with them falling in love again. And so what they do is they have that couple will be in the next book, but really the focus is on a different couple who's also in the same town. So you'll have like the Fool's Gold series, like, or, you know, one of these different sort of series about, it'll be all about the romances of a baseball team or the romances of a, I don't know, just whatever group they could, a family, a lot of times they'll have, it'll be like the Walker Saga or whatever it might be. And, or you'll have it all be about cowboys on a ranch in one story. Yeah. Will be about, and so if I feel like for these Hallmark sequels, instead of going all of a sudden all dark and putting all these, this weird conflict on our couple, it would be better, I think, if the couple was there and we got an arc for them, maybe they're planning a party or whatever. And then you have new couple coming in that they're kind of mentoring or matchmaking or something fun. And so you get that. So that's what I think would
work. Well, and what I found immensely satisfying with Gift to Remember, both as the book and then in the eventual film, is getting a holiday story that has a satisfying little bit of mystery to be solved.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's engaging a completely different set of senses.
That's true.
And I wanted in the follow-up, Darcy and Aiden are a couple in the beginning, and I can swear to you they will be a couple in the end, and they are a couple all the way through. And so, spoiler alert, we are not setting up like some false love triangle or weird fight. And maybe because I was working on the pitch for that as I was preparing for my own wedding, I want to know them as a couple. I want to know them as a team. And I want to see them finding the solution to whatever kind of puzzle needs to be solved in this one. I want to see how they do that together, because that makes me root for them as a couple. And that's the difference for me in the first story and the second. The first is how we met, and the second is who we are.
Yeah.
And I don't have to threaten to break them up to make you care, you know?
Yes. You're nailing it. I love it. Yeah. All right. Well, before we go, we do at the end of interviews, we call it the Teen Beat questions. These are just some fun.
Oh, I get to do the TV questions. I'm so excited.
These are just our fun, silly questions. And so the Amber found an issue of Teen Beat. So here we go. The first one, what is the best ice cream flavor?
The best ice cream flavor is Jenny's Ice Cream in Atlanta does Fluffer Nutter.
Ooh.
And it is a marshmallow ice cream with a peanut butter swirl. And it is the best dang thing you ever tasted.
<That sounds laughs>
And
so
it's
good.
The reason we all suffer from obesity in the South.
well earned, well deserved. It's worth it. All right.
Earn it, dang it.
Okay, number two, favorite color.
My favorite color is red.
Oh, very on brand. That's very good. Okay, what music are you listening to right now? Are you into?
The thing I'm loving right now is Jamie Cullum. Scottish singer-songwriter, and I need something when I'm writing that puts me in the headspace of the tone of the piece that I'm working on. Uh-huh. And Jamie Cullum at the piano is so perfect for writing a Hallmark movie. Uh-huh. And then I don't have to listen to Christmas music in March.
Why not? I mean, come on.
Because I do not live alone, and there are other people's things to consider.
All right. So what's your go-to date night food?
Pizza. It's always going to be pizza if I'm the one choosing, which is why it's better if my husband chooses. Otherwise, you are getting pizza.
That's funny. All right. What is your go-to date night activity? Go out and do.
We love a movie night. We love a movie night. And they've got, you know, the fancy theater here where you've got like the recliner seats, and they bring drinks to your seats and like, you know, treat you like a VIP. And that's a really great night out. I love that.
That's fun.
We're kind of boring.
The only risk of those kinds of theaters is that I sometimes fight the sleepy problem. And if I'm too comfortable, it's almost a problem. Like, I am going to fall asleep. But yeah, there's movies that put me to sleep and there's movies where I fall asleep. It's a
where you just
scenario because I'm so tired. But okay. So dogs or cats?
Oh God, I have a dog and a cat. I couldn't possibly choose between my love for each of them, but in terms of tolerable behavior, I am much more of a dog person and my husband is more of a cat person.
See, and you get along. That's the perfect combination then. Okay. So beaches or mountains?
Mountains.
Okay, good.
I am Scottish and sunburn very easily. So okay. The beach just isn't that interesting to me.
All right. Suit and tie or sweats?
Oh, please sweats. Please.
Okay.
If I am putting on a suit, it means that I am having to live up to somebody else's expectations.
Yeah.
Because I don't put on a suit to go to the dang grocery store. Like, clearly it's not my choice. You know? Yeah.
And then a tie. That's, Okay. Your favorite holiday?
My favorite holiday, probably Halloween.
Mm.
Because Daniel, I mean, I always liked Halloween, but then I met Daniel, who loves Halloween and taught me how to do Halloween right. So, like, this past year, we moved up to the suburbs last May, and so this is our first time living together in a proper neighborhood, and we were the house that gave away full-size candy bars.
Nice.
So, like, we were kings of the neighborhood that night.
Yes, you were. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I really like Halloween too. I really enjoy planning my costume. And I've always said, once I finally meet Mr. Sunshine, if he doesn't agree to do couples costumes, I will be so furious. Because I've been looking forward to that for my whole life.
And I guess, I mean, the thing I love about it, like, of course, everybody has their own Christmas traditions.
Right.
But Halloween, like, is open to so many different interpretations.
Yeah.
And it's so much fun to see what people's individual take is on what scares you. That's a really broad spectrum. And you'll be pleased to know that this last year, he went as Jaws and I went as Quint, and we had a real good time.
Oh, I'm so proud of you. Very good. All right. Last question. Very difficult. And you can pick one of your own. No judgment. What is your favorite Hallmark movie?
You are so mean. I mean, I feel like if I don't say one of my own, I'm not really earning my paycheck. But at the same time, oh, golly. Because of the fact that it literally changed my life, I have to say My Summer Prince.
Oh, that's cool. Really good.
And because I made some really good friends out of that as well. And that was just before Taylor Cole's moment happened.
Yeah.
And because now she is a Hallmark queen. And like watching her trajectory and watching the audience fall in love with her the same way we did on set has just been immensely gratifying. It's really great to see good people get the appreciation they deserve. And I love having been in the early stages of that.
Well, and it's just Utah. I mean, that's why it's your favorite.
Yeah, and it's Utah, which again, guys, you got to see Utah in warm weather. It's really amazing.
Yeah. It's really great. Well, you have been a delight. This has been so much fun to talk with you. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. And where can people find you on social media? All that fun stuff.
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter at Topher Payne. That's TOPHERPAYNE. You'll get to hear any of the gossip I'm allowed to reveal about upcoming film projects. You'll also hear about my stage projects, some of which may be very unexpected if you're only familiar with my Hallmark work. But I've got plays happening all over the country, so I would sure love for people to see it. And you can go to topherpayne.com and find out about everything I ever wrote.
Great. We'll have that all in the description section. People definitely should check that out. And thanks again. This was really, really fun. And
you are the best. This was great.
Well, I will have to definitely have you on again because this was really fun. So
thank you. I would love to come back and talk about movies I can't talk about right now.
Yes. Well, definitely do it for sure. Really like to thank Topher for coming on the podcast. That was so much fun. He is just the best. And we had a great time talking with him. So let us know what you think about the things we talked about as far as rom-coms and writing and the different movies, all that fun stuff. Definitely share with us your thoughts. We would really appreciate it. So Easter is coming up and we have a really exciting new sponsor for the podcast that we are working with Russell Stover Chocolates. And they have a really cool new feature where you can build your own box of chocolates on their website for your friends and family and have the perfect Easter gift. And what could be better than that for the Hallmarkie in your life? And if you're interested, check out our link of hallmarkiespodcast.com/chocolate and you'll really enjoy building your own box of chocolates. So thanks so much to Topher again. And if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Rachel's Reviews on iTunes and YouTube. I really appreciate that. And make sure you're following the podcast at Hallmark Beast Pod, all of our social media. We try to post something every single day. We love hearing your feedback and your comments on the things that we're talking about. It's so much fun. And if you're listening on iTunes, if you can leave your ratings and reviews, we really appreciate it. And if you're listening on YouTube, please give us your thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. That would be great. So thanks so much. And we will talk to you all later this week where we are doing our Merry Madness bracket with Alonzo Giraldi and Emma from the Hallmark. And so you'll really enjoy that. So thanks so much. And we'll talk to you all later. Bye.